Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Today's episode is brought to you by Cars.com. With over 2 million vehicles and 50,000 more added every day, Cars.com will match you with the perfect car for you, your budget, your life, your style. And if you're ready to say goodbye to your current car, Cars.com will get you an instant offer to cash it in. Just start by entering your license plate and get matched with a local dealer who will write you the check. So whether you're looking to buy or sell, just go to Cars.com. It's magical.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Monday Morning Deep Dish. My name is Shepard Price, and with me today is Dave Milton. Say hi to the people, Dave.
Hi to the people, Dave.
Today, in honor of Tuesday's game against the Florida Panthers, the Blackhawks have a day off today, but they'll be facing Florida, whose logo resembles their new head coach.
Yes, it does. Alarmingly so.
Yes, and that is former Blackhawks head coach, the legend, maybe the greatest head coach in the history of Chicago sports, Phil Jackson, is the debate. Joel Quenneville.
Yeah, that would be an interesting debate because, I mean, Jackson was great and all, but he also had, you know, Jordan and Pippen and Rodman, and Taves and Kane are great, but they are not too hockey what Michael Jordan was to basketball. But
no.
We'll have to cross that bridge. Maybe that'll be the summer thing we yell at each other about.
Yes. Maybe that's the offseason episode.
There we go. All right. Yeah. Little teaser for the summer.
Yeah. So while we start, let's start talking about Q at the beginning. Since I wasn't around, I became a fan and sort of the
lockout. You were dead. You were dead.
2012. No. So you were around in 2010, I assume.
I was, yes. Very much so.
What are your memories of sort of the time when Denny Savard was fired by the Blackhawks to make room for Joel Quenneville?
It was really weird timing because I believe the Blackhawks won the last game of Dennis Savard's tenure. And I'm going to look this up as I'm talking, but, and hopefully this doesn't ruin everything, but it was 3 or 4 games into the season, it was a very quick move, and I think there was some surprise, especially because of Dennis Savard having the standing he does within the organization. You know, he's a Hall of Fame hockey player. The Hawks lost the first 3 games, then they beat the Coyotes, and then they fired Savard. So it was really weird. But I think it was always kind of the writing on the wall was that Quenneville was going to come in because they hired him in some weird organizational position, and it always seemed like he was going to be the head coach of the team soon. And the main thing I remember when they hired Quenneville, the knock on him at the time, from what I remember, is that he was a good coach in the regular season, but he couldn't quite get it done in the postseason because he had really good teams in Colorado and he had some really good teams in St. Louis, but they never seemed to pan out when the postseason came around. So I think I was slightly worried about the fact that maybe he can't get this team over the hump. And maybe this will just be another team, just another series of teams that are good but not great, even despite the talent that they were assembling. So there's a little bit of concern there, but I think those concerns were immediately relieved. Maybe not immediately, but the first postseason the Hawks had under Quenneville when they beat Calgary in 5 games, which was – you know, I don't think was too much of a shock. But then when they went into and went to face a Vancouver team that they were not as seasoned as Vancouver was at the time, and they beat them pretty handily, as handily as you can in a 6-game series, that's when it started to seem like Quenneville's definitely the guy for this job. And then I think it just kind of evolved from there to where they won 3 cups. And in hindsight now, I mean, it looks like such a great move, and I don't think anybody can say anything bad about it now. But I think when that move first happened, I was a little bit worried.
Yeah, especially considering the Blackhawks were coming off of a really deep playoff run without the greatest free agent signing in the history of Chicago sports, Marian Hossa.
Yeah. There's another fun debate, but yeah, like they were just like, you knew something good was happening. Like with Savard's last season, the Hawks they just missed the playoffs. Just barely. I think it was like 3 or 4 points that they ended up missing that last year. But even as you went into that offseason, you knew something special was being built. And I think it was the following summer when they signed Hossa, because the year they signed Hossa is the year they won the first cup. But anyway, it was just like another layer on top of this momentum that was building in Chicago. And then when they added a coach that had been around the NHL for a decade, even though he may not have had the Stanley Cup pedigree that you would have wanted necessarily, there was still this thought that this guy knows how to win. This guy knows what's going on. And it seemed like it added another layer of credibility to what the Blackhawks were building.
Right. And he had a Jack Adams coming in from his time in St. Louis.
Yeah. He had some very good team. I mean, any Blackhawks fan should have been familiar with Quenneville because he coached St. Louis and Colorado, and Chicago played those teams a ton. And St. Louis in the 99-2000 season, I think that was the year they won the President's Trophy. They had, I'm looking at it now, they had 114 points. So he had some really good teams. Never seemed to pan out in the playoffs for whatever reason. Obviously he fixed that in Chicago, but yeah, it was just another legitimization of what was coming about.
It was a move that sort of cemented it, that like Gerard Gallant in Vegas that made it a real organization.
Yeah. I mean, you knew with like Taves and Kane were coming of age and Keith and Seabrook and Yalmerson were all starting to come up. Even some of the depth guys like Dave Bolin and Christopher Stieg and Andrew Ladd, like some of those guys were starting to develop too. And your Burrish and Ben Eagers and Colin Frazier's, everything was starting to come together. And I think the coach was a question mark. It was just, you know, I mean, to make a comparison, it was just like the Cubs when they had all their studs coming up and Ricky Renteria was their manager. And there was some question about how much of a contender he could make a team. So then they went out and got Joe Maddon, and then they went and won the World Series. I think it's a very similar story with what the Blackhawks did. Although the Blackhawks did it first, so the Cubs just copied them.
Exactly, and the Cubs fired their manager in a shorter time span than the Blackhawks did.
Theirs. Yeah. The afterburn for between Matt and Quenneville is a lot different though, just because I mean, obviously Quenneville had much more success. I think the Cubs wish they had what the Blackhawks have right now, but they still got time to get there, I guess.
Let's talk about Quenneville's system a little bit, since we're currently in the midst of having to watch Jeremy Colliton's, and it's a completely different system. At least I think Jeremy Colliton wants it to be.
Yeah. Like he was trying just to make his mark and do something completely different than what Quenneville did. But I think just the number one thought, and I think this is what I appreciated so much about Joel Quenneville, was he was kind of like – he gave off that vibe that he was like an old school guy. But the way he wanted his team to play was decidedly not old school. It was a very much preached a puck possession type of game. He wanted defensemen joining the play when they could. He wanted offense. He wanted offense to be more, you know, it was a team that seemed like entirely centered around puck movement and puck possession, which wasn't really the old school way to do it. And it was a combination of a very good system that was paired with the perfect type of team to execute it, because the Hawks had defensemen who were capable of cutting off injuries at the blue line, getting possession back, and then giving it to the forwards and then going the other direction. And I think Duncan Keith might've been the absolute perfect player for that type of system, because that like seemed like the Hawks' main things during that entire last decade was you're not going to gain injury against the Hawks, and the Hawks are going to skate the puck into the zone because of how they break out of their own end and get through the neutral zone. And those two factors, the Hawks really did that better than anyone, and they were doing it before anyone else really was, and that's what led to them being so successful. I wouldn't call it like a revolutionary thing. Like I don't think Quenneville was ever the first person to come up with it, but the Hawks just did it so well that they won 3 cups in 6 years.
Right, and it wasn't like the trap where it was boring hockey. It was always sort of this exciting game where the Blackhawks sort of built on their speed.
Oh yeah, it was so much fun to watch. It was counterattack city. Like every time, you know, when Keith or Seabrook or Yalmerson, whoever it was, would cut off a play at the blue line, and then one or two quick passes quick transition the other way. Like, it felt like they scored in transition more than any hockey team I'd ever watched in my life. And that's fun hockey. That's not like dump and chase, run a cycle in the corner for 5 minutes, and then the puck kicks out to the point and a shot just happens to go in. Like, this was really, really fun, exciting, back and forth hockey that was very pleasing to the eye, and it was a lot of fun just because they kept winning with it.
Right, and you watched any of, like, the Blackhawks' legendary goals from that time span when they had Quenneville, a lot of the time it was from right in front of the net that the shot came from.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they were able to pick apart teams just with their passing and their skating ability because they had the skill, they had the players with the hands and the feet able to do it, and not a lot of other teams had that ability.
Yeah. And Quenneville sort of, he elevated the players he had too, because you look at Brian Campbell and the course sort of career he had after the Blackhawks, and even Dustin Byfuglien didn't have the same level of success after he left the Blackhawks. He hasn't won a cup in Winnipeg.
Yeah, and I think that's should be one of the enduring legacies of the Quenneville area, because there were so many players that achieved the best years of their career, or the best eras of their career under Quenneville's watch. I mean, Duncan Keith was good, but he became great under Quenneville. Brent Seabrook realized his first-round potential under Quenneville. Hjalmarsson did. I mean, Johnny Oduya was fine in his other – he was in, like, Winnipeg. I think he played with the Thrashers same franchise, Winnipeg and the Thrashers. But Oduya came to Chicago and was phenomenal on that pairing with Hjalmarsson. I mean, there were so many – it seemed like it was always guys on the blue line, because I believe Quenneville was a defenseman himself during his yep. playing career. So he knew how to get the most out of his own defenseman, and he knew how to – I guess he just seemed like he knew how to get these guys to play the way he wanted to play. And he also seemed like he put these guys in position to maximize their abilities. Like, for example, the Hjalmarsson-Oduya pairing that I referenced earlier, like, that was the prototypical shutdown pairing for that team for about 3 to 4 seasons, starting with the 2013 team all the way through the cup year in 2015. And I think Oduya left that following summer. So for 3 seasons, anytime they needed a defensive play, Hjalmarsson and Oduya were out there to handle it. And that allowed Keith and Seabrook to be slightly more offensive oriented, since they didn't have to take on the top line of the opponents. So Keith was able to really work the transition game that made him so effective. Brent Seabrook was able to do his 50 or 100-foot stretch passes that became the hallmark of his career. And those two pairings alone were a significant portion of why the Hawks were so good for so many years. I mean, I think you remember the 2015 season when I vividly remember them talking about it on the post-game show after one of the playoff games. I think it was during the Ducks series, when they listed the ice times, and Keith and Seabrook, Hjalmarsson and Oduya had played like between 80 to 90% of the game. And the other pairing was Leddy and Roosevelt saw maybe like 5, 6, 7 minutes. And they were saying on TV, like, I don't know how they're going to win a series with these guys playing this many minutes, but it worked. So, like, that's the overarching trump card you have with everything Quenneville did, but it worked for so long. Right. It worked. So you can't really, you don't really have anything else to say other than it worked.
Right. And talking about that sort of shutdown pairing, that was another signature of the Quenneville era, was the sort of shutdown line that you had guys like Andrew Shaw and Andrew Desjardins and especially Dave Boland and Michael Frolik and Marcus Kruger, the guys who sort of just shut down the top line of the opponent and let Kane and Taves and Hossa and all those legends sort of just drive offense.
I think I didn't really understand this concept in hockey until Quenneville became the coach and they started talking about it, the idea of chasing matchups on the ice. And whenever the Hawks played at home, they had the last change. It was Dave for the first cup and maybe the second one too, that it was the Dave Boland line. I think the first cup, it would have been Boland, Ladd, and Versteeg would always be out for defensive draws against the Sedin lines or the Thornton line or whoever, or the Flyers top line. I can't even remember who it was at the time, but Boland would always be the guy. And then the 13 cup, it was Boland, Frolik, I think, and Kruger, I think, was that line. And then in 2015, like you mentioned, it was Kruger, Desjardins, and Shaw. And those three lines, not only did they take the toughest assignments, were usually starting in the defensive zone, but typically they ended up on the positive side of the possession ledger, which is
it's hard.
It's very difficult to do. Like, not a lot of lines can do that. But Quinville seemed to always be able to find that group and then have success with that line. And then not only do you absorb your opponent's strongest punch every single time you're on the ice, but then that frees up the line with Taves on it and the line with Canes on it. Those lines are freed up to attack against a inferior matchup. And, again, that's part of what made the Hawks so successful, is that their top offensive players didn't have to face the top players from the other team because their shutdown line could handle it.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's exactly what they haven't had since 2015, because they've never really replaced the Oduya and Hjalmarsson pairing, although it seems like they might be getting there with Connor Murphy this season. And they haven't really got that good shutdown checking line since Kruger left the first time he left town. When he came back the second time, it didn't click quite as well for whatever reason.
Yeah. I mean, there might be some hope in Smith, Carpenter, and maybe Andrew Shaw, but
yeah, there is some potential. I think now it's like you need to get the top six situated, get Dylan Strome back into the lineup, and then figure out what your top six is going to be, and then those bottom two lines, then you can figure out who's going to be your shutdown line with either Highmore or Highmore, Smith, Carpenter, Kajula, maybe. I mean, pick your whatever pairing you want, but maybe the Hawks can figure that out in the weeks ahead.
Right. But it's also not like Jeremy Colliton's system relies on sort of having that shutdown line either.
No, and I don't know if he harps on matchups as much as Quinville did. It seemed like Quinville was so, like, one of my main memories of watching the Hawks is when they would have a matchup that wasn't quite what they wanted, the Hawks would win the draw, dump it in, and head for a change to get the matchup that Quinville wanted. That always seemed like that was such a major point of emphasis in the postseason, to get the guys on the ice that he wanted in each situation. He never wanted to, as much as he could control it, he wanted to have a matchup that benefited his team.
And also, again, talking about the players he had that he also elevated, but he had a lot of great talent with him.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he got the prime of Jonathan Taves. He got the prime of Patrick Kane, Duncan Keith, Brent Seabrook. He had, I think one of the most impressive things is that they won the cup in 2010 with Antti Niemi, who turned out to be kind of just a guy. Like, he was good. There were several games in the Sharks series that he kind of won by himself, but they got to the first game of the Stanley Cup final, he gave up 5 goals. And the Hawks still won that game and won the series. So there was never, I think that was just such an impressive thing that they were able to win despite ever having that first team didn't really have a great goalie. The other two had Corey Crawford, who was very good, and that helped, that just made them even stronger. That's why that team rolled through everybody in 2013, because Crawford and Emery played so well behind a team of 18 skaters that were just phenomenal. But yeah, Quinville got a ton of talent, and he also really maximized so much of that talent.
Yeah, and that's exactly what you want in a coach, is that if you give him a good team like Bowman and Talon gave Quinville, that coach will maximize them.
And like, and on the other side of that coin too, it seemed like whenever he seemed to sour on a prospect, Quinville, like in hindsight, he ended up being proven right. Like, there aren't too many guys from that era. I really can't think of anyone from that era, that one of the younger guys who seemed like he should have cracked the lineup but never did, but then went somewhere else and had a great career. I mean,
right? Like, you imagine, you remember like Free Morin,
yes,
that campaign,
that's,
and Peary.
You always start with Jeremy Morin and Brandon Peary. Those are always the top two guys who just never seemed to pan out in Chicago. And Peary had some moments in some other teams, but he never like really sustained a career anywhere else. Jeremy Morin never did. Dylan Olsen never did. I think the closest you could come up with is Nick Leddy, and I think that was more of a salary cap thing, to where the Hawks knew they probably weren't going to be able to pay him, so they shipped him out and got a piece in return for him. But I'm trying to think of some of the other prospects around that time that were always seemed to be fringe guys but never quite made it to the NHL level. But there were so many guys that, like, it seemed like Quinville just didn't trust or didn't have faith in. And he seemed to be proven right every single time, because the guys would end up in another organization and never really amounted to much of anything.
Right. Even in his later years with guys like Trevor Daley and Ryan Garbutt and those guys, Yuri Sakak, they all washed. Well, not Trevor Daley washed out of the league yet, but they all didn't. They didn't go on to like great sustained success.
I mean, Trevor Daley pretty much washed out of the league because he's playing with the Red Wings. That barely counts as an NHL team anymore. And also, Daley was just more of a personnel thing where, or it was like a, I'm trying to think of the word for it, but I remember the big issue there is Quenneville wanted his defensemen to pass the puck out of their own end, and Trevor Daley wanted to skate the puck out of his own end, and that created enough of a friction between coach and player that they ended up trading Trevor Daley. So it was more like a strategic disagreement between the players than a talent thing, and that's fine.
Still, he rigidly stuck to a system that worked. It won three cups.
And he had every right to. I mean, you can't some of the disagreements that it was obvious him and Stan Bowman weren't always the best of friends. They were more coworkers than anything else. But when they brought Barry Smith in at a practice to run the power play when the power play was garbage, which is a perpetual theme in the Blackhawks organization, apparently. But
yes,
like Quenneville, like there, I've seen so many accounts of how much that infuriated Quenneville to have somebody else come in and like to do something different than what Quenneville wanted, because he had his way of doing things. He had his way. He had his belief of what worked in winning games at the NHL level. And again, he ended up being proven right pretty much all the time.
I mean, again, we talk about the power play that was never good under Quenneville, but that was the one thing that wasn't good, because the PK worked and the 5-on-5 really worked.
And it was very much proven during Quenneville's tenure that you can get by without a good power play. I think if you had to pick between a good power play or a good penalty kill, after watching what the Hawks did earlier this decade, I'll always take the good penalty kill over the good power play, because it seems like being able to prevent goals in that situation is more important than being able to score goals.
Right, because you can always get you.
At least that's the way it seems so far, which I guess the fact that the Hawks have a very good power or penalty kill this season, maybe that's encouraging that things won't be so miserable when we get to April, but we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. I mean, they're on a roll right now.
I know, yeah. We'll get to that when we do Musings on Madison later this week. I'm having more fun watching the Hawks the last week than I have in years. Maybe not years, but it's been. Yeah, we'll talk about it later. It's been a lot of fun. I'm talking to you. The Hawks just finished beating the Jets, and that was a very enjoyable game to watch. I never was really worried they were going to lose, surprisingly.
How caught up are you on Joel Quenneville's current team in Florida?
Somewhat. I mean, I know. Does it count if I say I have Aaron Ekblad on my fantasy team?
I believe it does.
Does that mean anything to you?
Jonathan Huberdeau, the leader in points for the Florida Panthers?
Yeah, well, I had to trade him because I had Dougie Hamilton and I needed defensive help, so I had to trade somebody. Yeah. I was either going to trade him or I could keep Kane, Ovechkin, and McKinnon, so I traded Huberdeau. Is that good? Do you think that's good?
I think that's good.
Okay, yeah. Thanks. I'm glad I have your approval. But yeah, there was a big article at The Athletic about Quenneville's team now seems very similar to what Quenneville inherited when he first came to Chicago, because he has all this young budding talent with Huberdeau and Ekblad, and there's so many other guys, and I just drew a complete blank with all the names, so I'm going to have to go to their hockey reference page and figure it all out. And
Sasha Barkov.
Sasha Barkov, that's the other big name I couldn't spit out. But yeah, and then Evgeny Dadonov, Mike Hoffman, and then they have some guys that look interesting, like Keith Yandel was always one that he seemed like – I feel like he was always like rumored to end up in Chicago just because he seemed like he was always available at the deadline for whatever reason. And it always seemed like he was going to end up in Chicago because he might have his skills, because he has that kind of the ability to jump in during a play that Quenneville really liked out of his defenseman. So the fact that he's playing with Quenneville down in Florida kind of made sense. But yeah, there's a lot of talent there. I don't think it's quite as good
No.
As it was in Chicago, or the team that he inherited in Chicago. But like, it wouldn't be a shock at all to see Florida kind of in the next few seasons take off. I don't know if I'm going to predict that they're going to win the cup, but I could see them getting past the first round and maybe making into some dents into the second or third round of the playoffs in the next few seasons.
Right. But Joel Quenneville's system sort of relies on getting that above expectations performance from a goaltender. And that's not what you're getting from Sergei Bobrovsky this season.
No, you are not. Everyone said Sergei Bobrovsky. I was reading tons of articles about him at the start of the season, again, because of fantasy hockey, but everyone said he always started slow. Like, he always has a rough October, November. Well, we are now halfway through January. His save percentage is still under 900. His goals against average is still over 3. Hockey Reference has his goals saved above average at negative 11, which is not good, Bob. So, yeah, it's
horrible.
Like we're talking about with Quenneville's system, like, he won with Anti-Miami because the team in front of him was phenomenal. He doesn't quite have that talent, so I think he needs a goal. He's relying on a goaltender a little bit heavier than he might have wanted to, and he's not getting it. I mean, right now, like, the backup, Chris Dreiger, I don't know how to say that name, Dreiger, he was kind of outplaying Bobrovsky for a while, and I think he's down for 2 or 3 weeks with an injury. So it's all bad news in Florida, although that does bode well for the Blackhawks because they play Quenneville's team on Tuesday night. And if they're going to keep this playoff chase going, they're going to need to win there. Although I should mention, as we're discussing this, that's Monday's game. So they haven't played that one yet. But the last 6 games Florida's played, they've won 5 of them. Actually, 6 of 7. So there's a whole lot of W's going back to mid-December. They're kind of on fire. So that's going to make for a very interesting game on Tuesday night. I'm already feeling overtime already.
As you talked about last week on Musings on Madison, we sort of just expected 2 wins from this weekend. We already got that. So
I know. Yeah. We're already playing with house money, Shepard.
Anything against the Florida Panthers is icing on the cake.
Absolutely.
This is advertiser content brought to you by Frito-Lay.
Hello, I'm Chip Murphy, here to get you ready for the big tournament. Tonight we break down who will be cutting. Cut! What are you two doing?
Sorry, Chip. Prez here got his feathers ruffled when I told him Ruffles has zero chance of winning the title.
And I was letting Dip know that she is not taking into account Ruffles' iconic ridges.
Guys, it's March. We have to start talking about the tournament.
We are. It is the 2023 Frito-Lay Snack-It.
We're talking about big-time matchups between Cheetos, Smartfood, Lay's, Sun Chips, and more.
Just head to the Frito-Lay Snack Bracket and vote for your favorite chip, pretzel, or dip for a chance to win up to $1,000 or a year's worth of snacks.
This sounds great. Keep up the good work.
Just go to Frito-LaySnackIt.SBNation.com. No purchase necessary. Sweepstakes ends 4/3/2023. Void where prohibited. Here's worth of snacks awarded in the form of 52 coupons, each good for 1 bag of chips. See official rules at Frito-LaySnackIt.SBNation.com.
But besides peanut butter and the sort of antics that Joel Quenneville had on the bench and mentioning how much of a player's coach he sort of was, which is not what he's sort of known for, but like, all the players loved him. And you remember sort of the mourning they went into when they fired him last season, especially Kane and Taves. Is there anything else you want to say about Joel Quenneville?
Well, of course, it's going to be disappointing whenever an era like that ends. I think that was one of the most disappointing thing about Quenneville getting fired, is it kind of felt like that was one of the most concrete examples of that era coming to an end. Like, it kind of started when some of the players started leaving, like, especially when Hossa had to retire. It started feeling like all of the magic that you'd been able to be a part of for the last decade was kind of dying out. And so Quenneville getting fired was kind of the end of all of that. It definitely took away from a significant part of what had made the last decade so fun, because now some of the faces are that made everything so much fun weren't around anymore. But I think just my favorite thing of Joel Quenneville is just all the memes. It was so much fun. Like all of the things you talk about, like the antics on the bench, when he jumped up in St. Louis after Seabrook killed Backes, and he was up on the bench just screaming his head off. And then there was like somebody photoshopped a GIF and it made it look like he was like on the middle of the dance floor and Dirty Dancing, like just straight with a disco ball and everything.
Yep.
It was so good. Like all the mustache jokes, the Q-stash Twitter account, which I haven't really seen, or Coach Q's mustache Twitter account, which kind of went dark after he left town. I mean, the peanut butter, all the F-bombs on all of the shows, the image of him appearing already to be pretty drunk, smoking a cigar, lifting the cup and dancing with it over his head after one of the cups. I think that was the 2013 one. It was so much fun. I think Quenneville was a significant part of all that fun, because while he has this kind of gruff exterior and he can certainly light up a ref with F-bombs, I think he had more fun than just about any of the players did. And I think because of the fun he had, I think all of the people watching it had plenty of fun as well, including myself. So he was like in Chicago, at least, he's like the hockey equivalent of Mike Ditka, and right. Wildly more successful than Mike Ditka.
Wildly more successful. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, and then like all the Benny's commercials,
That he had a sort of Chicago accent without being from Chicago.
Yeah, exactly. Like he seemed like a kind of, you could walk into a bar right now, any corner bar in Chicago, and if Joel Quenneville sat next to you and started talking, he wouldn't sound out of place. And right. I think that was another part of what endeared him to everyone in Chicago, is he kind of looked like a Chicagoan with the mustache and everything. He sounded like one. He probably drank like one. It was the perfect combination of like coaching personality with coaching style and all the players. It just, everything kind of meshed perfectly when Quenneville came to Chicago, and it made for one hell of a decade of hockey.
Right, and he definitely tailgated Bears games like in Chicago.
Oh, my God. The week after he got fired, he was doing shot skis in the parking lot of Soldier Field. And I feel like that was like the quintessential Joel Quenneville thing to do, is to be ripping shots in the crowd with fans a week after he got fired. Because, you know, I mean, after some people got fired, yeah, they would probably go to the bar too. He just happened to go to a parking lot tailgate, which is another thing that you do in Chicago. You go get drunk before a Bears game, so... Yeah, he fit in very well in this city, and it's pretty I would love to get his honest thoughts about what it's like in Florida, because I can't imagine he's having the same experience down there. It's just the hockey, it's not in that traditional hockey market. The team isn't quite as successful, so the fans aren't there. I'm sure it's not quite the same. I don't imagine they've got sellouts every night down there, so... I wonder if you could get him. I wonder how much what he really thinks about that market. But with the way he is, being so buttoned up to the media, I don't think you'll ever get him to say it, even after he moves on somewhere else.
It's just it, and at this point in his career, what else do you have to accomplish? Your name's on the cup three times.
Well, I mean,
you're already known as one of the greatest coaches in hockey history.
Yeah. Well, I think with guys like him, and this, you could say this about so many just professional athletes and coaches in general, is the competitiveness that made them so successful is not something they can turn off. So even though he won three cups in Chicago, and like you said, has cemented his name and his legacy in the NHL is fully intact, no matter what he does for the rest of his career from an on-ice perspective, he still wants to go win a fourth cup and probably a fifth cup. And so like he can't stop that competitive drive. Maybe when he gets into like his 70s and decides to retire for good, you know, then maybe he can turn that off. But that competitive streak is what makes him a good coach, but it's also what's going to make sure he's not satisfied with what he's at right now. He probably wants to keep winning. And he sounds like there was a quote from, I think was referenced in that Athletic article, that nobody likes winning more than I do. And that was, I believe, a direct Joel Quenneville quote. And so he's going back to Florida so he can win some more games.
Yeah. Win some more playoff rounds, too.
Hopefully. I'm sure if Florida makes the playoffs, I'm sure there will be plenty of people in Chicago pulling for that team solely because of Joel Quenneville.
And also because the Blackhawks might not be there.
Well, you know, 2 weeks ago I would have said that with a lot more confidence than I can right now.
Oh. Do you, in your opinion, knowing Q as we do, do you think he ever makes the transition to a managerial sort of GM job?
Oh, I would think not. I would assume he's a coach, and when he decides he doesn't want to coach anymore, he's done. I don't imagine. It seems like he has the competitiveness and he wants the hands-on approach of being a coach. Like I don't know if he could, like, scouting is more of a passive thing. You're kind of sitting back and watching everything. It would seem like somebody like him, and I don't know, I've never had the chance to interview him or talk to him personally, so I don't know this. This is all my entire speculation, but I would think he would never want to do a desk job, essentially. Like, he needs to be coaching, like, down on the ice behind the bench every game if he's going to be involved in hockey, or he's not going to be involved in hockey at all.
Well, do you want to talk, now that we've sort of thrown all this heap of praise on him, do you want to sort of talk about the downfall?
I guess. I mean, we have, because he ultimately was fired. He didn't resign, so.
Right.
Yeah. And it's not that, like, every coach has their blind spots. Like, there is no such thing as a perfect hockey coach. And I think that one of the knocks on Quenneville was his line blending, where it seemed like he would over-tinker with lines to the point where you couldn't get any chemistry with players. And then I think that was a big one. I think, I imagine it frustrated, like, especially Patrick Kane, because he wanted to, you know, he wanted to have consistent line mates so he could build chemistry and get some offensive production out of that group. But he could never build that chemistry because Quenneville was always tinkering the lines, sometimes doing it between periods, sometimes doing it during a period, just because that's the way Quenneville thought he could get his team to play better. And then right. I think another one of the things was just he was definitely stuck in his ways, which isn't necessarily a bad thing when those ways are working, but when they're not, when things aren't going well and you're not as willing to adjust, that's when job security can start becoming an issue, if you're not willing to adjust when things aren't going well on the ice. And I think the ultimate downfall of Quenneville, honestly, was the fact that him and Stan Bowman never had the best relationship, and that when the Hawks stopped winning, Bowman finally had leverage with which to use to get Quenneville removed from his position, and that's ultimately what did it. From an on-ice perspective, there weren't too many things that Quenneville, I thought, did wrong.
Right.
And you feel free, like, there's some more I'm missing here. I'm sure there's something I'm missing, but there's – he didn't do a ton of things wrong. I think it was just, it got to the point where what he was doing, the rest of the league had caught up to it and had figured it out and started doing something different to counter it. And he wasn't willing to adjust with that. And he also didn't quite have the personnel that he originally had to execute the type of hockey he wanted to play. And that ultimately led to a regression by the team and ultimately led to him getting fired. Yeah. But if there's something else I'm missing, I'm sure there's other things out there that other people would point out about why he didn't have his job anymore.
The sort of stretch pass was sort of everybody caught on to it. I think there's a few players he sort of – we talked about how he sort of didn't miss out on anybody. I think there's a few players he sort of forced out that the Blackhawks really use right now. Michael Kempney comes to mind first.
Michael, all right. I should retract and – well, somewhat retract. That's the only player – that I can think of that never seemed to fit in Chicago. Although someone did a really good video breakdown that there was a few plays where Kempney was kind of slack on his skate to the bench for a change. And there was two goals, I think, that came about because Kempney was slow getting to the bench. The player coming on for him was behind the play, and it led to an odd man rush and a goal. So. Right. Yeah, you can probably fault Quenneville somewhat for not using Kempney in a way that maximizes his ability, but I don't think the player is entirely innocent in that situation either. And maybe right. he's fixed that in Washington. Maybe the coach in Washington doesn't care as much about that, but that is, I don't think Quinville's the only person at fault there. So maybe that's one player. And then yeah, that's the only one I can think of.
Right. Because everybody else that the sort of Blackhawks traded out or traded for wasn't really on Quinville as much as it was on Bowman thinking players would fit in his system.
Yeah. And again, and that kind of goes back to the less than good relationship those two had, but every now and then they would sign a player. It's like Bowman would sign a guy and be like, here, Joel, like this guy. And oh, here comes Brandon Manning. And it's like, and from like the first game you saw him in preseason when Arthur Nassir from Detroit roasted him for a goal, it was pretty obvious Brandon Manning wasn't going to be long for Chicago. So again, and I think that just goes back to the frosty relationship between those two was more of the issue than anything else. But yeah, Quinville certainly had a type of a player that he really appreciated. And near the end of his tenure in Chicago, they were trying to find that piece, but they were finding like the worst possible examples of that piece.
Yeah.
Like the stay-at-home defenseman type. And it always ended badly. And so, yeah.
And I remember how, like, I remember the publicity of Q's sort of rant after he found out both Panarin and Hammer, but especially Hammer, were traded on the same day.
Yeah. I remember, was that ever like publicly made? I know, like, obviously they didn't want to, like, he didn't do it like on the record or anything like that. I remember hearing there was some frustration from Quinville because of how good Panarin was, and he obviously significantly relied upon Hammer to do so many things for him, but I don't remember, like, did you ever see anything tangible?
There were stories okay. about how angry he was that day.
Yeah. I'm sure he was, because that's, I mean, Panarin was one thing, but I just because of how good Panarin was, but I mean, you won three cups with Hjalmarsson, so
yeah.
Something's, yeah. It was probably more of the fact that he probably wasn't clued in on that trade was coming down. That was probably the more angering part for him.
And besides, I think Brandon's side was more of a Joel Quenneville player than Panarin was.
Right.
At least at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of revisionist history with Panarin at this point.
Yeah.
Because it's hard.
My take on Panarin is that he would have left the season for the Rangers anyway.
Oh yeah, I don't think the Hawks ever could have afforded him. So, the interesting debate for me is whether or not he, if he would have been as good in elsewhere as he if he'd stayed in Chicago, if he would have been as good here as he's been everywhere else, and I'm sure he probably would have in hindsight. I don't know if I was that confident at the time that he would be like this incredible superstar player outside of Chicago,
right.
Not on the line with Kane. He certainly is now, and you know, more power to him. And he was, I still love watching him because he's just a great hockey player.
All right. Anything else you want to mention about the former coach of our lives, Joel Quenneville?
Coach of our lives. No, I missed the memes. I think that was,
because Jeremy Colleton doesn't have any personality. That's the real thing about Jeremy Colleton.
The closest thing to an interesting thing about Jeremy Colleton is whether or not he's wearing eyeglasses on the bench for a game. And that's Brandon Kane's every time, just for the people that are listening to this know, every time you see the tweet from the Second City Hockey account about whether or not he's wearing glasses, Brandon Kane is probably responsible for it because I never even noticed. But yeah, that's the – the fact that the most interesting thing about the guy is his accessories is not a good sign.
No.
And it was, Quinville, yeah. And just the way Quinville could, when he got really pissed off, the way that he would berate officials was hilarious.
Most entertaining thing.
Oh my God. There's so many good ones. Like if you Google Joel Quinville GIFs, so many of them are him yelling at officials. And I wish they would have been more mic'd up. Like the NHL they probably can't do it because it would just be a never-ending string of F-bombs. But if there were more people mic'd up in the NHL, I think we'd have a much better appreciation of all the personalities in this league, because I'm sure they all say hilarious things, but also I'm sure a lot of the things that players say on the ice, they don't want making it to the light of day, including the coaches. But the one where the lasting memory I think of Joe Quenneville, and this might be inappropriate or like unfair to him, but when he was standing on the bench during the playoff game against St. Louis, grabbing his balls and yelling it, I don't remember what he was saying, but he got fined for that. But it was just
enduring legacy is how passionate he was.
Yeah, yeah, it's how intense he was. And there was another one. I think it was after. No, wasn't it? It was a game against Arizona where he was on the bench. I think they overturned a goal, and there's a gif of him absolutely losing his mind. There's, again, the gif I mentioned earlier of him lifting the cup and getting a beer poured on his head. I think that was in Boston. There's a never-ending string of Joel Quenneville gifs and memes and everything that he brought to the franchise, just brought to the era, and he made it fun. He was a very fun part of a very fun era of Blackhawks hockey. Probably the most fun era of Blackhawks hockey I'll experience in my lifetime, which is a little sad to say out loud, but that's what it was.
Yeah. I don't know if a team will ever win three cups in 6 years again. And so that was the most, and they had chances and more. I don't think we'll ever see anything like that. And that was in part because in a medium-sized chunk of it, because it's Joel Quenneville.
Yeah. And I just remembered another, I'm clicking through Joel Quenneville gifts right now. And I encourage you, if any of you are having a bad day and you're listening to this, go to Google, type in Joel Quenneville gifts, and just click on them, because they're all great. They're just, I won't even spoil any more of them. Just let you watch them, because they're all a delight. I highly recommend it.
With that said, I think that's what we have to say about Joel Quenneville. We'll see him again on Tuesday against the Panthers. Until then, ladies and gentlemen, have a good Monday. And we'll see you at Second City Hockey on Tuesday. I'm Shepard Price. With me is Dave Melton. He's at _DaveMelton. And this has been Monday Morning Deep Dish. We'll see you next time.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.